Backyard Green Films is proud to present this episode of Agriculture with your host, Alara Bowman. Alara and her husband, Rick, travel throughout the land in their teardrop trailer that they have nicknamed Maggie, bringing you stories about their travels and the people they meet. They visit farmers, ranchers, and just about anyone who loves putting their hands in the dirt or their feet in stirrups. For the past 3 years, they have been filming a documentary about heritage breed animals entitled The Holstein Dilemma, Heritage Breeds, and the Need for Biodiversity. In those travels, they have gotten to meet some very interesting people. Here's one of those interviews.
Hi, I'm Alara, and welcome back to our agriculture podcast. We mostly drive from place to place as we do our interviews, so we get a good feel for the look of the land as we go. As we drove across Kansas, I was constantly reminded that this was an area heavily impacted by the Dust Bowl crisis that hit this country in the 1930s. The food production methodologies that we had used for dryland farming across the prairies in all of North America had caused devastating drought conditions across the plains, and it lasted for the better part of a decade. Soil ecology and the importance of maintaining arable topsoil are concepts that should not be taken lightly in one of our most production agricultural regions. It's a lesson we once learned, but now we seem to be forgetting it. Today we bring you some snippets from our conversation with Hank Will. Aside from being an experienced agriculturalist, Hank is a journalist and a writer. He's editor-in-chief for Mother Earth News magazine and editorial director at Ogden Publications, which publishes Grit, Capper's Farmer, and many other journals that I really enjoy reading. We spoke with him at his Osage County farm, Prairie Turnip Farm, that is, on a brisk but sunny day right after visiting the Mother Earth News Fair in Topeka, Kansas. It was October, so the farming had mostly been done for the year and the animals were starting to put on a little bit of their winter coats. Hank took me out to walk the fields, and you can hear the field stubble and the volunteer greenery crunching underneath our feet as we walk along. Our feet would sink into the soil as we walked, and a light wind was constant. It again brought to mind to me the 1930s and how different it might have looked if we'd stood in the same place 80 years earlier. We also had a closer encounter with the Highland cattle herd, who were definitely less interested in talking to me than I was to them. I have to take my hat off to Rick as he managed not to go head over tail as he filmed while we walked along. Hank is quite an experienced farmer. It would take me half an hour to list most of his accomplishments and his life experience. I would highly recommend a web search or a visit to his Wikipedia page for more information. He has written quite a few books and numerous magazine articles in many areas of agriculture and rural living. His interests include vintage farm machinery, animal husbandry, marketing, soil health, and many other areas. Among other agricultural products, Hank is raising Scottish Highland cattle, various ground crops, and is developing a new variant of sheep based on three other breeds. He's got quite a bit of experience in raising pigs, chickens, and small niche crops like sprouts. He seems to be, above all, a very practical guy. He understands and utilizes the best components of his science background and farm experience, and he combines them with an understanding of the principles of economics, marketing, conservation, genetics, and purpose. What is it that I want my farm and its products to do, and how do I make it happen? He has an obvious love for the regenerative ability of the land, if we give it a chance to do so, through careful management practices. Our interview ran like a comfortable conversation with my next-door neighbor, and I was not expecting that, but I enjoyed it immensely. He's the kind of person that you might like to sit on a porch and drink iced tea with when we're talking about life. We're doing a film on biodiversity and why it's important to us, specifically in agriculture. We've found that diversity also applies to the personalities and mindsets of the people that bring our food to us. Each is important in their own way, and it brings a different thing to the table. We use the word sustainability a lot in our lives these days, and it's come to be a little bit pigeonholed, I think. To my mind, it's primarily about finding the right balance. How do I make it possible to do and keep doing what I want something to do over the long run? Hank Will is emblematic of that in many ways, and it was a wonderful experience to see that concept referred to not only in his words during our conversation, but also in the way he illustrated that in a practical sense in his farming life over time. It's Mother's Day, and Earth Day is just past us, and Mother Earth News is obviously a strong connection in Hank's life, so we felt that this podcast interview was apropos in the literal sense. It's also conceptually perfect for me, as I believe that one of the main purposes for a mother or any parent is to prepare their child to be able to take care of itself when the time comes. The cycle can continue and they can do the same for their children with as few inputs as necessary. Hank does that on his land, allowing Mother Earth to be as self-sufficient as possible while preparing for the next generation. Sustainability at its best, you might say. So with no further ado, here is Hank Will.
If you would tell me your name and give me your professional background. I'm sure you have a couple letters behind your name,
Lord.
Too.
Yeah, so my name is Oscar Henry Will III. My people call me Hank, so I go by Hank, but at most of my official publications, and when I say official, I really mean science and books and things like that, I use Oscar H. Will III as my byline. So a lot of people don't, you know, necessarily, they're searching for Hank Will, and they won't necessarily bring up those things. Because I just assume you're going to go Google search me.
Oh, I've already done that.
Oh, you've already done that. Anyway, so, you know, pretty conventional childhood, growing up, went to college, went to graduate school, really wanted to be a genetics professor, do research and stuff like that. Let's go this way. And did that, you know, did the professoring thing. I went to school in Chicago. I had three job offers, and the lowest paying job offer was in South Dakota, but that was the closest to home.
Okay.
So that's where I went, and had a decent 15-year academic career. Was building my own farm at that time. We made hay, did about 4,000 free-range broilers. This was before free-range broilers were cool. I direct marketed those. I should say we direct marketed those. This would be back in the early 90s. And then one thing led to another. Our farm, we sold, raised and sold native perennial flowers or plants, you know, field grown, so that I could sell a huge tub of Leatris or something for, you know, $30. Sioux Falls, South Dakota was burgeoning at the time with building, and so the landscapers loved to plant semi-mature stuff, even though I would always feel slightly guilty because transplanting huge plants in flower, you know, you sort of diminish the possibility of them surviving.
What the market will bear.
Yes, right. So, did that. Chasing after my wife, we went to Ohio. I sold my farm in South Dakota. I was going to try to manage it from there, but that wasn't going to work. And so I rolled it into a farm in Central Ohio, near Mount Vernon. Beautiful grass farm. And that's where I really got into the sort of, we, you know, quadrupled our Angus herd and really got into the intensive management grazing thing. And I did purebred Angus in those years. Well, I taught a few classes at the local college too, but I, you know, just because I could, and I needed something to do to keep me out of pool rooms and whatnot. And let's see, then she took a job in California at Whittier College.
Okay.
And so I had this huge farm sale in Ohio, sold everything, land.
Okay, so we're in Kansas.
So rural Osage County, Kansas. I don't really know what all to tell you about it. It's sort of at the interface between kind of riverine woodlands and some upland hardwood forests and the tallgrass prairie. just to the west of us is the Flint Hills.
And I look at this, and you have little trees here and there. Do you know if that's something that was more of a recent event, or is that a Dust Bowl reaction, or is this kind of the native vegetation?
That's a really interesting question. So in this part of the state, trees would be probably the climax. They will take over if you don't burn or mow or some combination of those things.
Really?
Yeah, so I mean, it would have been managed. The uplands would have probably been naturally managed as fairly open grasslands or mildly, you know, sparsely populated savannas. But the trees that come right up out of the ravines and the river gullies, you know, and they'll work their way up across the pastures. So one of our principal species here is hackberry, and it's just a really, I'd say, robust tree. It survives drought, survives cold, survives heat, and it's native. And then also Osage orange. Most of the Osage orange here were planted, and I'll show you some big ones as we walk out. They were used. They're really native to a really small part of Oklahoma and Texas. It's called sometimes the woody ternal or bow wood because they make good longbows.
Why can't we have romantic names like the woody ternal? I mean, that just sounds like a beautiful thing, doesn't
it? Isn't that great? Yeah, yeah. And then it almost got driven to extinction by the railroad because it's super dense, super hard, and fence posts planted in the ground will last around here where it's fairly damp for 50, 60 years.
Wow.
Without rotting. Mm-hmm.
So is this the norm? Is it always this wet? What is it like?
No, it's really wet for this particular season. It's much greener than it normally is. So our habitat here is really warm season grasses. They're grasses that come on in the heat of the summer, late spring, and they usually go dormant with the first frost. But you will see some stands of it that I haven't mowed or haven't been grazed too heavily, like this area, that you see their seed heads. They stand tall, and they're turning amber right now, amber and kind of, I don't know, beige, whatever that color is. But we're much greener than normal because we had, although it was a drought year, we had really well-timed rain events from, say, 1/4 inch to 3/4 inch. So we're still short for the year, maybe 6 or 7 inches. But the way it was timed, we managed to pull off great hay crops and in this region and great corn if the corn was planted early enough. Corn, you could have it right across the road from each other, and some of it had to be chopped for silage because it wouldn't fill grain because it was so dry. And the rest of it's combined, and it's, you know, average yields. It's not high yields. It's not a good way to make money anyway, commodity corn.
Yeah. But you're a fan of letting nature solve problems for you, is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. If you can give it a little nudge, or if you can, you know, set something up so that the natural systems are at some advantage over the things that you're trying to manage, that's always my goal. It's way more fun. You got to use your head a lot more than you got to use your body, and it's, you know, it's, to me, it's a great puzzle.
It's a little subtler, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a lot subtler. Yeah, sure.
Not a big stick. This is a gentler thing. May we walk up
and look
at this? That would be great.
Let's go see if we can find the cows.
So, you know, this is kind of interesting to me, you talking about this, the branching into the heritage breed portion of this, because that's another one of those things where people talk about, you know, the advantages that you can have by allowing nature to do things for you that you don't necessarily want. So if I live in Florida and there's big, huge bugs, or if I live in Oregon and I've got a lot of parasites up there that are going to come through, there's a lot of animals that will naturally tolerate these things, correct?
Oh, absolutely. So my scientific background is in genetics, and, you know, I'm a firm believer in using genetics to sort of work towards solutions that suit you. And so I've been working on what I call a land race of sheep. So in the olden days, and most heritage breeds would fall into this category, most of them were developed as land races, not all of them. And a land race is essentially a population that's been line bred to some extent, or interbred a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, they were born and they died and they thrived, in a specific region. It could be as specific as somebody's farm. Okay? And then after three generations, there's... Oh, here's the cows. There's a population of critters that are perfectly adapted to the conditions at that location.
Is that really only a three-generation possibility there? Or?
Oh, it can take you much more than three. And when I say generation, I meant human generation.
Okay.
Yeah, so a lot of years.
Because that's a big difference there, isn't it?
A lot of years of animal breeding. So I have sheep that are part Katahdin. They're about the foundation stock. I'd say it's probably roughly 80%, 90% Katahdin. I got to do my math right here. About 7-8% Corsican, and the rest is Dorper. So they're all hair breeds, and they require. I selected really hard in the early years for parasite resistance and disease resistance. And we don't, you know, I still have some syringes and I still have a little bit of antibiotic, but we haven't done any parasite control on them for 9 years.
Okay, so now you said something that I got really, that was very interesting to me. You just kind of gave up your recipe, didn't you?
And when
you... isn't that sort of the thing?
I share the knowledge, man. I don't want to sell them. They work right here, but they're not going to work 20 miles from here. Or they might work 20 miles from
okay.
here.
Okay, you're saying all the right stuff, because this is something that we've been going over. We, you know, heritage breed animals are developed over time to do a certain thing in a certain place. And yet, when we were talking to Matt yesterday with the Katahdins, one of the things that he said was, if they stay here in this area, they might lose a little of that pest resistance. So you have to constantly keep improving and upgrading.
You just gotta go, okay... If you see a problem, go get a ram that's purebred Corsican and inject some more resistance into your flock.
You need the ingredients, but then you don't have pure, right? Right.
And the people who are into the pure, which I have no problem with that.
Yes.
But if you're into the pure, if you're selecting for a look, a confirmation, even some genetic alleles, you're not selecting for parasite resistance or good mothering. I mean, usually you would float those traits on top of everything, but you can do it much more quickly if you're willing to stir the pot, basically.
Okay, so the economist in me says, untrained as I am, says you're kind of outsourcing specialty things from the places where they become specialties.
Absolutely.
And so if you keep that ability to really maximize that characteristic, it's great to keep them separate, and we all have something to offer in diversity.
Right?
Right,
no, absolutely.
So you go to the St. Croix Island, and you get the sheep, and you put them in something in Oregon.
And see if they can hack it here, or someplace.
Yes.
Or maybe some of them can, and maybe they're not really super thrifty here, but if you can get a few crosses, what do the crossbreeds look like? What does a quarter cross look? What does an eighth cross look like?
Yes.
You know, so you can, if you're a good... If you're good at selecting and you're patient and you have time, you can eventually get an animal that looks pretty much however you want it to look, that does performance-wise whatever you want it to do. But it takes time and energy, and a lot of times people fall in love with looks. So if you look at, you know, a lot of the heritage breeds and a lot of the purebred dog standards and all of that stuff, you know, it's a lot of it's got to do with how they look or what their physical sort of stature looks like.
Right. And back of us is a great example of that. Those Highland cows are very unique, and boy, do they look interesting.
And they're, you know, probably really more predisposed to northern climates, but they do fine here in Kansas. And we've managed to find some females whose offspring shed pretty well. And so we don't have any issues with fly strike. And in the hot summer, they'll blow that fall coat off, or the winter coat off, and look a lot more slick. But most of them are already sort of getting into their winter.
A little shaggy.
Yeah, and that's not so much temperature driven. It's partly temperature driven, but it's also partly day length driven.
So this is one of those things that the purists versus the people that say, you know what, I'm going to improve this breed.
Yeah, yeah, or make it do what you want it to do.
Yeah, yeah. But there's a little bit of a war going on.
That's because it's humans, right?
Yes.
Everybody wants to be right. The fact of the matter is nobody's right,
yes,
or everybody's right. But you don't have to beat each other up about it.
Yes.
It's like, what are you after? If you want to have a perfect Scottish-style Highland line, and you want to do it in Kansas, you're going to have to pump them full of all kinds of parasite, and you're probably going to have to shear them. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Because they're not genetically predisposed to thrive here.
Yes.
And it took us a number of generations to get really, really good calving rates. And it was all about fly strike.
Yeah.
You know, so they'd calve in, oh, late April, maybe, May, which is usually when I tried to time them, because we have good grass then. And the wet little fuzzy babies would come out, and the bot flies would,
just be all over.
And the bottle flies would be all over them.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we would, you know, we were spraying iodine on them. I mean, we didn't lose more than probably two to that, but then we had females whose offspring never got fly strike. So you can guess what I did with the females whose babies did get fly strike.
Yeah.
I sold them to somebody.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody who, you know, just wanted to have these cute fuzzy cows, and they were going to treat them like pets, and they'd be in the barn, and they were happy to shear them and all of that stuff.
So I look at that, and that's the perfect example of how all of this can coexist. Well, I mean, we've been talking to people. We're not political with film that we're working on. We're not anti-production, because we've got a lot of people on the planet that we need to feed, you know, production is good. But also, you know, the individual farmers and ranchers that are traditionalists and saying we need to conserve this breed, that's a really valuable thing too, because you can say, hey, I want that characteristic.
Yeah.
So everybody can win
from it. It's a genetic repository that everybody can draw on down the road. I think the biggest fear that I could have is that we would so specialize and everybody would raise the same genetic lines that, you know, you could lose some stuff. Could you get it back eventually? Yeah, maybe through mutation and whatnot. But yeah, I think they go together, because people like me, guys like me, I can say I really want to put together a breed that, or actually just a group of cattle. I don't even care if it's really a breed, you know, that does this, tolerates my management scheme, and thrives.
But that's how all of these animals came to be over time anyway, right? The Spaniards brought the cattle into Florida.
Right.
They get loose, they run around, and the ones
eventually we have the piney woods.
Eventually you have a piney woods or a Florida cracker. You know, these are the ones that make it. They either make it or don't. And so over the course of...
It's the selection. And it's brutal to select. I mean, people don't like to have to select.
Yes.
Because they fall in love with their little critters.
Yeah.
Or it's like a stock certificate, you know, so... If you're looking at it as dollars and you're culling, you know, you got to find a market for the culls. You don't call them culls.
Yes.
Or you got to send them to the sale barn and take a hit.
Yeah.
Know, so.
But the cull doesn't necessarily mean you kill it.
I have
eight chickens in my little San Diego farm. I have no intention of breeding them because we can't have roosters.
You can't have roosters.
But you know what? I bought my chickens from, I think, either My Pet Chicken or Murray Ben Murray, one of those hatcheries.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm sure it was somebody's cull. It's not a show chicken.
No, exactly.
But it works beautifully for me. So that secondary market is very...
Super important.
Is important for farmers that actually do want to make those breeding decisions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, totally. So, you know, you could even go so far as to say, so this Highland group traces at least the bulk of its foundation stock to a large Highland ranch west of Auburn, Kansas.
Okay.
I think it's called Oz Highlands. And if we took and stood them side by side with a herd that had lived for a few generations, not a few human generations, say in Vermont or New Hampshire, they would look different.
Yes.
They would behave different. They'd have different horn structure, you know. And that's just the fact of the matter, that there's going to be some inbreeding.
Yeah.
Unless you're religiously AI everything.
Yes.
Which you can do.
Which is also an interesting thing to me, because one of the... the benefits of heritage breed animals is that they naturally can procreate,
yeah,
correct?
Totally.
So that's one of those things
and take
that
care of themselves and yeah.
Okay, so this is something I wanted to ask you about. We don't have to, you can always tell us to either shut that off or you don't have to answer this because I know that you have responsibilities in your position of at the magazine. But mankind's goals is to progress and constantly adapt.
Right.
And you have a magazine. Are we okay on this one here?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
That's just a cow. And they're all friendly.
Just as long as they don't get too 3 feet behind you, babe, just in case you hear footsteps.
He'll let me know.
Or she'll let you know.
She'll go this way.
So one of mankind's goals is to adapt and to progress.
Progress, yeah.
And that's a relative term depending on who you speak with.
Oh, God, absolutely, yeah.
You are involved with a magazine that is a cross of traditional values and, hey, new and great ways to do things. And so it's the same thing in many ways, I'm assuming, as the traditionalists and heritage breeds and the people that say, I can use that breed and cross it and make some things. How do you handle that? Yeah. It's kind of a philosophical out.
Yeah, I think the way I look at it is there's, you know, if you want skinned cats, there's a million ways to skin the cat. And so if you want to preserve genetic diversity in any kind of livestock or poultry, you want to have people who are enthusiastically preserving specific types of diversity, and you want to have people who are actually figuring out ways to actually make a living using that stuff without selling breeding stock or what have you. And so sometimes you can do both with the same group. Depends on where you are and what the genetic background of your animals is and what your ultimate goals are. For me, I'm a lazy guy. I'm not really that lazy, but I am sort of a lazy farmer. I want my animals to be great moms. I want them to be able to have their babies without me, you know, nursemaiding them. And I want them to thrive under these conditions in my management scheme with minimal input from me. Obviously, they see us. They're not unused to humans at all. But I also don't want them to be pets. I want them to know that they're cattle so that we don't have bulls that, you know, decide that they're people and they want to mate somebody or I'm in competition with the bull for some cow or what have you. So, I mean, and again, I would say, you know, you never turn your back on a bull, no matter who it is. But I you know, it works. It can work, I think, for all those ends if, as humans, we can let it. So one of the many things that I find to be slightly annoying about people is the one way, my way, it's the right way. Everybody else is bad, I'm smarter, but I'm not going to share my secrets with you because you're going to have to pay me for it. It's like, I think that's, excuse me, you can't put this in there. That's bullshit.
So why can't we put that in there?
No, you can put that in there. Am I allowed to say bullshit on camera?
Well, we see it when I say no.
Yeah. But anyway, you know, if we wanted to really elicit positive change, say environmentally speaking with agriculture, there are so many different ways to approach that, and the groups, the organizations, the like-minded folks who find each other, who start their own little movement, they're so focused on being right that they actually forget to loop in all of the other people who are working on the same goal but from a different angle, and they spend so much energy beating each other up, and they're so small then they can't do anything. They have no voice against sort of the larger scale, I would call it conventional agriculture, again, which I don't have a huge issue with other than pollution and animal welfare and trespass, you know, drift trespass and things like that. If we really wanted to leave this world a little bit better for the subsequent generations, and if our plan of attack was in agriculture, we should be making coalitions with all of the groups who, for whom that's the outcome, that, or that's the goal, and put our differences aside, you know? You want to spray your animals with something for the flies? I don't have an issue with it. You can't call them organic unless it's an organic approved thing. No problem. But we don't have to fight each other. If I want to do it organically and you don't, why do we have to be enemies? If our actual goal is to manage the land in a way that will build soil, because soil is really, really sort of what it's all about.
Yeah. If you liked our podcast, please subscribe. This is how we keep going. And please tell your friends to join us.
We want to thank Hank Wheel for having us out at his Prairie Turnip Farm today. For more information about Hank Wheel and Mother Earth News Magazine, please visit MotherEarthNews.com. If you're interested in attending a Mother Earth News Fair, they're held all throughout the land. You can visit and find out more information at MotherEarthNewsFair.com. You have been listening to Agriculture with your host, Alara Bowman. Please tune in for more upcoming episodes from our travels. We'd also like to thank our producer, Michelle Council. I'm Rick Bowman, your behind-the-scenes editor. Until next time. This has been a presentation of Backyard Green Films Productions, all rights reserved, copyright 2019.